This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Good evening and welcome to Navarra Live. My name is Aaron Bastani. Tonight I have the immense pleasure, the huge satisfaction of being joined by Michael Walker. Michael, how are we?
Very well. I'm glad to satisfy you and excited. What a crazy day in British politics it's been. I've just been just completely shocked every time I've seen a Tory speak. So I can't wait to go through it with you.
Yeah, we will be talking about the craziness, the perennial craziness that is the British Conservative Party. Coming up later this evening, updates on the US port set to be built on the Gaza coast to help deliver aid. We look at the situation in Haiti following unrest that has led to the resignation of that country's prime minister and ahead of a potential Labour government. Keir Starmer was grilled on Sky News regarding his plans for governing Britain. Stay tuned for all of that. But first, racism from a Tory donor. Well, I never. First story. Frank Hester is one of the Conservative Party's biggest donors, having handed them £10 million in the last year alone. But it's now emerged that he's made racist comments about Diane Abbott. The Guardian reports that, after calling a female executive, quote, the shittest person in a 2019 business meeting, Hester said this. It's like trying not to be racist, but you see Diane Abbott on the TV and you're just like, I hate. You just want to hate all black women because she's there. I don't hate all black women at all, but I think she should be shot. The executive and Diane Abbott need to be shot. Hester's company, the Phoenix Partnership, has received over £400 million in NHS contracts since 2016. It released this comment about his remarks. Frank Hester accepts that he was rude about Diane Abbott in a private meeting several years ago, but his criticism had nothing to do with her gender or colour of skin. The Guardian is right when it quotes Frank saying he abhors racism, not least because he experienced it as a child of Irish immigrants in the 1970s. He rang Diane Abbott twice today to try to apologise, directly for the hurt he has caused her, and is deeply sorry for his remarks. He wishes to make it clear that he regards racism as a poison which has no place in public life. Frank Hester also released another statement this afternoon in an attempt to get ahead of a further Guardian report, which quotes him as saying this. For me, racism is a hatred and a fear of the other. For me, it is exactly the same as homophobia. It's not limited to the colour of your skin. It's not limited to religion. It can just be the country next door. It can be Northerners and Southerners, which we have here. Apparently, you can be racist to Northerners. Who knew? Hester confirmed this is his view, but failed to confirm that he did indeed say the comments about Diane Abbott. On the morning media round, Tory ministers were attempting to defend their party over Hester. This is Work and Pensions Secretary Mel Stride.
It's clear that what he said was inappropriate. He has, as I understand it, apologised for those remarks. I think the critical point here is I don't think what he was saying was a gender-based or a race-based comment, but it was clearly inappropriate. He has apologised, and I think we need to move on from there.
Also trying to downplay the issue was Energy Minister Graham Stewart on Sky.
Mr. Hester has made clear that while he was rude, his criticism had nothing to do with the colour of her skin. Is that right?
He has been absolutely clear that he, although he spoke in an intemperate and rude manner...
Read what he said. He said, it's like trying not to be racist, but you see Diane Abbott on the television and you just want to hate all black women because she's there. I don't hate all black women, but I think she should be shot. Diane Abbott needs to be shot. I mean, that is based on the colour of her skin.
And they're truly awful remarks, aren't they? So there's nothing I can say apart from to condemn them and say that he's absolutely right to apologise.
So should the Conservative Party spokesperson yesterday have said it's got nothing to do with the colour of her skin?
Well, that's clearly what he said. He used the wrong language. He was annoyed with Diane Abbott and was making a wider point, but I'm not remotely tempted to try and defend it. He shouldn't have said it. It was half a decade ago in a private meeting, but that doesn't really excuse it, and that's why he's quite right to apologise profoundly, profusely, and completely, because Those words are not defensible, and I'm not here today in any way to seek to defend them.
So you know what my follow-up is? Should the Tory party return the money, the many millions he's given? Or are you okay to spend money that has come from him? He's only apologising because he's been caught out.
Yeah, and it's obviously, as I say, deeply regrettable. But everybody... we can't cancel anybody from participation in public life or indeed donating to parties because they said something intemperate and wrong in their past. And it's not my decision, but I do welcome those who support the Conservative Party to ensure that we have Rishi Sunak, of course, our first Hindu Prime Minister.
Not returning his money is something else. You're saying you welcome his money.
No, I said I welcome all those who seek to ensure that our first Hindu Prime Minister stays Prime Minister and that we don't have Keir Starmer becoming Prime Minister of this country.
So somebody else that might have said things like this in the past, you welcome their money?
I'm saying that I welcome those who contribute, and I'm not here to sit in judgment on one remark.
What a car crash. I'm not here to sit in judgment on one remark. You did. Literally a minute earlier, you say those are awful remarks. That's judging them. My goodness, imagine these people in a general election campaign. We should say that Business Secretary Kemi Badenoch, who's also a Minister for Women and Equalities, has this afternoon called Hester's comments racist, as has Kwasi Kwarteng, both Tory MPs of colour, although Kwarteng is off come the next general election. Michael, those ministers we showed are clearly being briefed to say the comments were rude and inappropriate, but they're refusing to say they were either racist or sexist. What do you make of those responses? And secondly, what do you make of Badenoch, who's very ambitious, very talented in her own way, breaking ranks with number 10?
Mel Stride was just repeating a line which the Conservative Party spokesperson or the Prime Minister's spokesperson said yesterday, which is these comments had nothing to do with race or gender. He literally said, it makes you want to hate black women. Like, it could not be any more explicit. You know, like in the anti-Semitism debate when it comes to Labour, sometimes you sort of say, oh, they've used a trope. And they say, well, they didn't, you know, maybe they've said that they were powerful and rich or something. And that is a trope, but they only said it. They didn't say it because they were Jewish, right? You know, there are lots of situations where one might accuse someone else of racism. You know, you've got a black politician and you say they're very aggressive. You say, well, I didn't say that because they were black. I said that because I think they're aggressive in this situation. There are grey areas when it comes to racism, and often someone's intentions aren't clear, right? So it's not always completely black and white. This one is. He said, you just want to hate all black women and she should be shot, right? It does not get any more clear cut than that. Right? Black women, right? He's not talking about Diane Abbott as Diane Abbott. He's saying he hates Diane Abbott and that makes him want to hate all black women, right? It's an open and shut case. And to have all of these Tory MPs go out there and pretend it's anything other than that is frankly bizarre. I mean, I don't know how much they need this £10 million, right? I mean, another element of this story, right, is he's their biggest donor and his whole career is based on getting contracts from the state. Now, I've got no idea if his IT company is the best in the business. His company is better at record keeping for the NHS than anyone else, right? But this guy has become a multimillionaire by winning these contracts. How is it appropriate for him to be the biggest donor to the main party, to the governing party? I mean, the Kemi Badenoch thing you mentioned there as well is interesting because, you know, Kemi Badenoch isn't to the left of the Conservative Party when it comes to sort of issues about race and identity. In a way, she's often sort of fronting their message to sort of say, oh, no, this thing that you think is racist isn't racist. You know, so she's very critical of sort of ideas of structural racism, sort of saying if there is a disparity, that's not necessarily because of racism. It could be for any number of reasons. It's obviously very critical of sort of definitions of Islamophobia. So she is not left wing on racism issues, but she is a black woman, right? And she's read this comment and she's like, I cannot possibly read that comment and not say it's both racist and misogynist. I think it's really, really embarrassing for the Conservative Party that the only people who seem to have come out and broken ranks, right? It's not because of their political leanings. It's not because they sort of have, you know, there is a faction of the Tory party that has a different perspective on race to other factions for sort of some ideological or philosophical reason. It's just there aren't the black politicians in the Conservative Party aren't willing to go along with this complete farce that you can say you don't like a black person, say that makes you want to hate all black people, and then pretend that the hatred has nothing to do with race. Like, it's completely bizarre. And yeah, Kemi Badenoch isn't willing to pretend. I mean, maybe it's because, as you say, you know, she's hopeful for a future Tory leadership election. It might just be that, you know, there's a limit to what she can go along with. And, you know, saying that it's this clearly racist statement is not racist is something she's not willing to do.
Who knows? I should say, Michael, as well, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, all the stick that was thrown at Jeremy Corbyn for being, you know, allegedly anti-Semitic. If only he had donated money to the Tory party, he would have been fine. Now we know how to rebut these claims coming from the right. Diane Abbott herself has released this statement in response. It is frightening. I live in Hackney and do not drive, so I find myself at weekends popping on a bus or even walking places more than most MPs. I am a single woman, and that makes me vulnerable anyway. But to hear someone talking like this is worrying. For all of my career as an MP, I thought it important not to live in a bubble, but to mix and mingle with ordinary people. The fact that some MPs have been murdered in recent years makes talk like this all the more alarming. I'm currently not a member of the Parliamentary Labour Party, but remain a member of the Labour Party itself, so I am hoping for the public support of Keir Starmer. Abbott is referring there to her suspension from the Parliamentary Labour Party. Keir Starmer removed the whip from Abbott almost a year ago, after she wrote a letter to The Guardian saying that racism could only be experienced by people of colour, while minorities who are racialised as white may experience prejudice. Abbott immediately retracted that letter and apologised. And yet the whip still hasn't been returned to her, a fact that even Labour rights stalwart and former Shadow Chancellor Ed Balls pointed out.
For Keir Starmer, she was suspended from the Parliamentary Labour Party a year ago for saying something which she probably shouldn't have said, and she apologised for
it.
She shouldn't have said it, and she's apologised for it. But actually, the fact that a year on, she's still outside the Parliamentary Labour Party, my personal view is she should be brought back following that apology, and she should be supported and defended for rather than left on her own, which is what's happening at the moment.
The Labour Party investigation into Abbott has still somehow not concluded. And Abbott herself said this in September. I am the longest serving black MP. There is a widespread sentiment that as a black woman and someone on the left of the party, that I will not get a fair hearing from this Labour leadership. In that context, it's more than a little rich for Labour MPs and bigwigs to now be calling out a Tory for abusing Diane Abbott. And this is what Keir Starmer had to say.
Comments about Diane Abbott are just abhorrent. And Diane has been a trailblazer. She has paved the way for others. She's probably faced more abuse than any other politician over the years on a sustained basis. And I'm sorry, this apology this morning that is pretending that what was said wasn't racist or anything to do with the fact she's a woman, I don't buy that, I'm afraid. And I think that it's time the Tory party called it out and returned the money.
Now, I found that ridiculous. You know, where there is political capital to be made, Keir Starmer is talking about her being a trailblazer. She's an extraordinary person, but I won't give her the whip back. When you can knock the other side, he'll sing her praises. And yet, in other circumstances, she's seemingly a liability, doesn't even deserve to be in the same party. Now, Starmer's record on dealing with anti-black racism isn't the best. Black Labour MPs wrote to him last year warning they were, quote, losing faith in his efforts to tackle a hierarchy of racism in the party. That's a reference to the bombshell Ford report published in 2022. It found, quote, serious problems of discrimination in the operations of the party. Labour MP Jess Phillips criticised Conservatives defending Hester's comments by saying this. It is, if it's indefensible, why try to defend it? Conservatives are so afraid of calling out racism when their own do it because they want to be seen as a little bit racist. This wasn't a little bit. It's not because they don't want to give the money back. It's because they are worried about offending racists. Now, this is the same Jess Phillips who claimed, quote, I told Diane Abbott to fuck off during a row about feminism in 2015. Elsewhere, Shadow Health Secretary Wes Streeting said this about the Hester affair. One day, when they've left office, ministers like Mel Stride will regret debasing themselves like this. It does show that the Conservative Party is rotten to its core and unfit for office. Well, here's the thing. Wes Streeting knows a thing or two about debasing himself. In 2018, Squawkbox reported this. In a parliamentary corridor, Streeting is alleged to have literally shouted in Miss Abbott's face, standing toe-to-toe with her and screaming, "Not my party!" in front of a number of onlookers. Witnesses described Streeting's behaviour as so intimidating that he had to be physically steered away from the Labour front bencher. Look, I have to say, if you behave like that in a workplace, you should be suspended. You should be disciplined. You should be punished. But of course, if the Labour leader, prior to 2020, Jeremy Corbyn, did anything, if he tried to sort of have any kind of discipline you would associate with a normal professional work environment, he would be battered from pillar to post by the media. Michael, there's a few things to unpack here. Obviously, I don't want to steer the conversation too far away from the substance of what this idiot has said. But at the same time, in particular, Keir Starmer's comments really struck me as so extraordinarily opportunistic. You know, here is an opportunity over the course of several days to bash the Conservative Party. So all of a sudden, I'm going to sing Diane Abbott's praises. He called her a trailblazer. And yet, he can't even give her the benefit of an expeditious process with regards to her being disciplined. You know, Diane Abbott has no idea when she may or may not be given the whip back. Some way to treat a trailblazer, isn't it?
The thing with Labour investigations is it is very they always take 2 years to investigate them. And it's like, we've all read the email, right? So you should be able to do the investigation within a week or so. I suppose, you know, it's important to say it's not inconsistent to say that Diane Abbott is a trailblazer, that this racism which has been directed at her is appalling. And that she sent a really quite offensive letter, actually, to The Observer and then apologised to it. And it's not inconsistent to say, and therefore, she shouldn't get the whip back. Like, obviously, I want her to get the whip back. I think she's apologised. I think there are MPs who've done much worse. And I also have absolutely zero faith in the disciplinary procedures in the Labour Party because I think it's pretty much a factional stitch-up. But it's not, you know, Keir Starmer can stand there and, you know, it's not ridiculous for him to say, she's a trailblazer, but she's made a mistake, which is so big that I'm not going to let her back into the party. And also, I'm absolutely, you know, repulsed to see the racism which is being directed at her. Though you can hold those three positions. I think we should be clear about that. As well, with sort of the Wes Streeting and the Jess Phillips case, I suppose in my previous answer, I was sort of saying sometimes it is sort of difficult to know for sure whether or not racism or racial insensitivity has been a sort of factor in a conflict or a disagreement. And I suppose in both the Wes Streeting and the Jess Phillips case, it is ambiguous. And so for them to sort of say, well, this Tory donor has said something which is clearly racist just because they have had a previous disagreement with Diane Abbott, even if we don't like how they behaved. Again, it's not completely inconsistent. So yeah, I would be reluctant to say, oh God, they haven't got a goddamn leg to stand on, because the things that have happened in the Labour Party are quite different to what this Tory donor has said, and then the Conservative Party saying there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. Or if anything, it's a little bit intemperate, but it's not racist or sexist. So, you know, I suppose I just want to separate my huge distrust of the Labour Party and my distrust of their disciplinary processes and my solidarity with Diane Abbott, who I think has been treated pretty appallingly by many people within the Labour Party, from sort of saying, oh, they're all the same. No one's got a leg to stand on. Do you know what I mean? I think I want to be consistent is what I'm saying.
Well, Michael, on the consistency point, you know, if you look at the substance of what was coming out in the Labour leaks documents, there were Labour staffers coordinating with mainstream media journalists who wanted to know where Diane Abbott was to effectively intimidate her, persecute her. And no, nobody was saying, they were saying some pretty bad things, by the way, including about Clive Lewis. Nobody was saying anything on this level. But I do find it extraordinary, Michael, that you had a party apparatus, her own side, were coordinating a campaign of malevolent persecution by the media. And that's kind of just pushed under the rug. And, you know, you have Wes Streeting. Michael, Diane Abbott now is 70 years old. You know, she would have been in her late 60s when that episode with Wes Streeting happened. You know, you're a bit younger than Wes Streeting. I'm about the same age. If you were being pulled away by colleagues because you were screaming at a woman in her late 60s, regardless of her skin color, I think you should be ashamed, frankly. So him using those words, I find, frankly, ridiculous. But I think you're right. My goodness. It's almost hard to believe this story, right? And like you say, finally, the Tories who say, well, this isn't racist. Imagine if Ash Sarkar had said, I see this white guy on TV. It makes me want to hate all white people. My God, that would be played 24 hours a day, 7 days a week across all the across the whole mainstream media, LBC phone-ins, James O'Brien breakdowns, front pages in The Sun. It would all be there. Next story. Haiti's unelected Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, has resigned after violence rocked the country's capital, Port-au-Prince, and caused a state of emergency to be declared. On the 29th of February, a series of attacks carried out by armed groups took place on government buildings and police stations in the capital and led to the release of 4,000 prisoners from the country's jails. In the days that followed, the disparate armed groups joined forces to oust Prime Minister, promising genocide if Henri did not step down. The United Nations estimates that thousands of people have been killed in the violence, with hundreds of thousands displaced. There have also been widespread reports of rape, torture, and kidnaps. Henri is currently in Puerto Rico, blocked from returning to Haiti by the closure of the airport and threats of violence. He made this statement following his resignation. For more than a week, our country has experienced an increase in acts of violence of all kinds perpetrated against the population. Assassinations, attacks against law enforcement, looting, systematic destruction of public and private buildings. We deplore the numerous losses of human life. The government that I lead cannot remain indifferent to the situation. As I've always said, no sacrifice is too great for our common homeland, Haiti. I'm asking all Haitians to remain calm and do everything they can for peace and stability to come back as fast as possible. Haitian leaders have now met in Jamaica to form a transitional government, but it's not clear that's going to satisfy the armed groups. Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier is a former policeman and now Haiti's most powerful paramilitary leader. He told reporters that if the international community backed a transitional government, it would, quote, plunge Haiti into further chaos. He added this, we Haitians have to decide who is going to be the head of the country and what model of government we want. We're also going to figure out how to get Haiti out of the misery it's in now. It's not clear how seriously to take that statement. The armed groups certainly seem to have political aims, but they're also reported to be funded by Haitian oligarchs based abroad and are armed with US weapons. But Cherizier is right to point out that Haitians have never been free to choose how their country is run. Ariel Henry came to power in 2021 following the assassination of Jovenel Moïse. His role was supposed to be temporary, but elections that were promised never materialized. In fact, Haiti has not had an election since 2016. And under Henri's watch, poverty in the world's poorest country increased dramatically. Last year, 97% of households in some areas suffered from severe hunger. That was according to aid agencies. And meanwhile, 280,000 children under six are expected to suffer acute malnutrition this year. But it would be unfair to place all of the blame for that situation at the feet of the most recent Prime Minister. After all, he's just the latest in a long line of Western-backed leaders who've stood in the way of self-determination for the Haitian population. In 1990, Jean-Bertrand Aristide became Haiti's first ever democratically elected president until he was ousted by a military-led coup the following year. In 1994, he was restored to power following the collapse of the military regime under US-led pressure. But in 2004, right-wing paramilitaries backed by the US, France, and Canada invaded the country from the neighboring Dominican Republic. They ransacked the country and forced Aristide into exile. The 2004 coup happened after Aristide demanded 21 $1 billion in reparations from France. That was for the money Haitians paid to the country over the course of, get this, 120 years to buy their own freedom from French slavery. And that coup was followed by more than a decade of foreign intervention. UN soldiers stationed in Haiti committed abuses against the civilian population, while foreign governments repeatedly interfered in every attempt to exercise democracy. In 2010, Haiti held an election following a devastating earthquake. Jemima Pierre is a Haitian-American professor at the University of British Columbia. She told Democracy Now! How those elections went.
One of the key things that happened is in 2010, after the earthquake in Haiti that killed hundreds of thousands, where the U.S. pushed the sitting president, René Préval, to have elections. And in the WikiLeaks papers revealed to us later that Hillary Clinton actually flew to Haiti and changed the election result, where Michel Martelly of the PHTK political party did not make the first round, but the U.S. forced the Haitian Election Council to actually make him, put him in the final, in the second round. And so establishing the PHTK, Michel Martelly, a neo Duvalierist, as Haiti's president, with under 20% of the people voting, with the largest political party in Haiti, La Valas, not being able to participate, we set the stage for what we see today.
The US, along with allies in the region, appears once again set to determine Haiti's future. The Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has traveled to the region to meet with CARICOM heads. That's the Political Union of American and Caribbean Nations. Speaking ahead of that visit, State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said this.
The proposal that is on the table that CARICOM has developed over the past several days in consultation with Haitian stakeholders and consultation with the United States would expedite a political transition through the creation of a broad-based independent presidential college to steer the country toward the deployment of a multinational security support mission and free and fair elections. And that's what I expect the secretary will be discussing with his colleagues.
Jemima Pierre gave this assessment of that plan's chance of success.
Now CARICOM is playing a different role where they're bringing the U.S., France, and Canada, the people who did the original sin, to pick our leaders again. And so the problem is, if this goes on and if they don't take into account other solutions that Haitians have been putting together, you know, in early 2021, you had La Famille Lavalas come up with Sali Public, which means that we need to start over and change the system. We had the Montana Accords. We have local groups that actually had a solution before the Moïse assassination. The U.S. government was trying to protect Moïse and basically ignored all these local solutions. And so now they cannot say that they're here to help Haiti as much as trying to figure out how to put in place another unpopular and illegal government. And so then we'll have the same problem a few years down the line.
Haiti now has every appearance of a failed state. There is not a single elected government official anywhere in the country. Its parliament, justice system, and basic services are not functioning. Economic growth stands at zero, while inflation has been over 15% for 3 years straight. And all of that is the result of decades of foreign interference, UN occupation, and anti-democratic governments, leaving its population of 12 million people facing a deeply uncertain future. This is a really interesting piece of news from our top story. Diane Abbott has reported the Conservative Party's biggest ever donor to the police. That's being reported in The Independent. As I said, I don't know substantially what that means. The political optics of it certainly aren't good if you report it to the police. It'll be interesting to see any other Tory MPs defending him if there is any kind of investigation into this. I'd call him gentleman, but he's really not. He's an absolute scoundrel. Next story. In his State of the Union address last week, President Biden announced plans to build a temporary port to get aid into Gaza. Uncle Sam to the rescue! We may be selling F-35s to Israel and giving them billions in aid, but we can't just leave starving Palestinian kids to die. Yet, according to the Jerusalem Post, the person behind that proposal was Benjamin Netanyahu. The Jerusalem Post writes this. A senior diplomatic source said Netanyahu took the initiative to establish maritime humanitarian aid for the civilian population in the Gaza Strip in collaboration with the Biden administration. On October 22nd, 2 weeks following the war's outbreak, Netanyahu discussed with President Biden the concept of, quote, delivering humanitarian aid to Gaza via the sea, contingent on Israeli inspection in Cyprus. Then, October 31st, Prime Minister Netanyahu outlined this strategy to Cypriot President Nikos Christolidis. The source added, in addition, the matter was revisited on January 19th, this is several months later, during a dialogue between Prime Minister Netanyahu and the President of the United States, where Netanyahu proposed, according to the source, quote, I want to suggest setting up a team to explore maritime supply through Cyprus after a thorough inspection of all goods. Now, here are Joe Biden's precise words announcing the plans during that State of the Union address. The United States has been leading international efforts to get more humanitarian assistance into Gaza. Tonight, I'm directing the US military to lead an emergency mission to establish a temporary pier in the Mediterranean on the Gaza coast that can receive large ships carrying food, water, medicine, and temporary shelters. This temporary pier would enable a massive increase in the amount of humanitarian assistance getting into Gaza every day, but Israel must also do its part. Interesting. Israel must also do its part, and apparently the US has been leading. Really? It's leading by following the proposals of Benjamin Netanyahu, the guy arguably responsible, I think inarguably responsible, for overseeing war crimes in Gaza. But Israel must also do its part. Yet they're proposing they'll do their part, which is to check everything, which is to effectively maintain a siege beyond this one little exception. If this source is to be believed, the entire proposal is Israel's. Now, this story has credibility because Israel's foreign minister, Israel Katz, floated this exact idea while meeting with the EU officials and diplomats in January. He even apparently showed them a video of the proposal. What is more, Katz previously dropped similar plans for a floating island off the coast of Gaza while serving as transport minister in 2017. This would be patrolled by Israel, allowing supplies, energy, and water to reach the territory. And naturally, Katz wanted the international community to pay for all of this, by which he means the European and US taxpayer. Michael, what do you make of this story? It's one of those, you just think, my goodness, I know that, you know, we're on the left, you're going to be critical of the US's role in international affairs, but I didn't realize it was so bad that the Israeli Prime Minister now fundamentally authors the centerpiece policy for an American president's State of the Union address. The mind boggles.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because sort of sometimes we're talking about how Israel really wants to starve the Gazans in a sort of act of ethnic cleansing to get them all to leave. At the same time, they seem to be talking to the United States about building temporary piers. And sort of those two things seem somewhat inconsistent. Why does Netanyahu want to get food in there if he's trying to starve them? And I think there probably are kind of different intentions that are all sort of acting towards the broader goal, which is Israel basically wants to have nothing to do with the Gazans. It wants them off their hands. Now, that could either be by kicking them out of Gaza, or it could be by saying Gaza is now the responsibility of other countries. It's got nothing to do with us, right? So, and I suppose you could see this as a way of them trying to set this precedent whereby it's not just aid organizations that are giving, you know, sort of servicing people in Gaza, but actually international governments. Because I think one thing the Israelis have sort of been proposing is they're saying, we want to basically completely destroy Hamas, and then we'll create this sort of buffer zone, which means that, you know, we can basically forget about the Gazans because it's going to be very difficult for us ever to face any consequences for this ongoing occupation, which we're managing. And also, by the way, can you Americans and Europeans sort of try and manage Gaza with some money from the Emiratis so that we can basically just say it's nothing to do with us? And then when sort of Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International put, I mean, not that Israel cares, but when these organizations put out their reports that say
You know, Gaza is a terrible place to live and it's not getting enough food. Israel can say, well, it's not our problem. This is, you know, you guys now control Gaza. So I think they want Gaza off their hands. Ideally, they'd want some of the land, but obviously we know they're much more interested in the land when it comes to the West Bank, because the West Bank has sort of more value both in terms of the land itself, sort of the agricultural capacity, but then also the religious significance of the West Bank is more important. One of the reasons why sort of Sharon gave Gaza, well, withdrew settlements from Gaza, was because he was like, well, Gaza is where we can maybe put the Palestinians and then we'll take their land from the West Bank. It was supposed to solve a demographic question. So this could be part of the Israelis basically trying to coax the Americans in to say, can you sort Gaza so we can just wash our hands of it after we've completely destroyed Hamas and any military capacity they have? Also, this would mean that Israel could say, you know, America, if you're going to run Gaza, you've also got to make sure that Hamas can never come to be again. So in a way, they want to have their cake and eat it, right? Get their war aims and then get someone else to do the rebuilding. I think they want this off their hands to some degree.
Want their cake and eat it. Israeli politicians, well, I never. Just on what you were saying there, Michael, Israel Katz, the person who's proposed this, is an annexationist. He would like Israel to absorb the West Bank and he would like Egypt to have Gaza. So I suspect you're right in that diagnosis. Long term, the plan is to probably create a really extensive security buffer zone in Gaza. You know, maybe that would be a third of the territory. And the other two thirds would be administered by the Egyptians. Like you say, they probably don't care. And the quote-unquote international community, from the Emiratis to the Europeans, the Americans, would help to rebuild Gaza. And of course, this will be sold to us as somehow a noble humanitarian endeavor. And who knows, you know, 30 years' time, you rebuild it all again, and it gets blown up again. And we keep on going through these motions, and yet no major politician in the US or the UK, in terms of the governing parties, of course, will say this is ridiculous. It's absurd. We're not doing it. Now, emergency relief isn't possible if you can't guarantee the safety of medical and healthcare workers. So this next story has even greater significance. Palestinian medical staff have told the BBC they were detained, blindfolded, forced to strip, and repeatedly beaten by Israeli troops after a raid at their hospital. The BBC reports this. Ahmed Abu Saba, a doctor at Nasser Hospital, described being held for a week in detention, where he said muzzled dogs were set upon him and his hand was broken by an Israeli soldier. His account closely matches those of two other medics who wanted to remain anonymous for fear of reprisals. They told the BBC they were humiliated, beaten, doused with cold water, and forced to kneel in uncomfortable positions for hours. They said they were detained for days before being released. Now, just to be clear, what's being described there is torture under any international definition. Extensive physical violence and stress positions absolutely comprise torture. At one point, Saba also believed he was about to be executed. Here's what he told the BBC. They put me on a chair and it was like a gallows. I heard sounds of ropes, so I thought I was going to be executed. After that, they broke a bottle, and it, the glass, cut my leg, and they left it to bleed. Then they started bringing doctor after doctor in and started putting them next to each other. I was hearing their names and their voices. In response, the IDF told the BBC it, quote, does not and has not carried out mock executions of detainees and rejects such claims. Here's Ahmed Abu Saba speaking to the BBC.
وضعونا في أرض تقريبا كلها حصمة وركبنا على الأرض وعنينا برضو كانوا مغميات يعني ما احنا فكرنا بدهم يدفنونا بعدين أخذ بصمة عيننا وقالنا أي واحد له جوال ورجيني إياه وزي هيك يعني بعدين نقلنا على إيش نقلنا على السجن لقيت في كذا دكتور معنا من المستشفى يعني وفي من التمريض موجودين من الإدارة موجودين زي هيك بالضبط واذا واحد اتحرك عمل شيء بعاقبه الكل طلعني برا عاقبني 3 ساعات ايدي مرفوعه زي هيك وراسي بالارض عاقبني 3 ساعات بعدين جابني لعنده لو خبطنا على ايدي ضل يخبط عبال ما انكسرت في مرات كثيره كنت متخيل اني خلص اني اخر دقيقه الي بالعمر
The IDF have said that torture is strictly prohibited by them, but beyond that, they've made no comment. Now, these claims are even more credible because there is video footage of men stripped their underwear in front of the hospital's emergency building with their hands behind their heads. Here's that shocking video. One can reasonably infer they're medical staff because, as you can see, there are medical robes lying in front of some of them. A detainee being transported in a hospital bed appears to have their hands bound. In response to this story, Dr. Lawrence Hill Cawthorne, co-director of the Centre for International Law at the University of Bristol, said this: "It goes against what has, for a long time, been a very fundamental idea in the law that applies in armed conflict, which is that hospitals and medical staff are protected. The fact that they treat nationals of the enemy's side should not in any way undermine that protection." Along with Dr. Abu Sabah, the BBC interviewed two other medics, and their stories were corroborated by separate sources. Families of five other medics at the same hospital have told the BBC their loved ones remain missing. Meanwhile, the International Committee of the Red Cross has confirmed to the BBC it has received dozens of phone calls from people who say family members, including medics at Nasser Hospital, are now missing. Obviously, this has a profound impact on the ability of the hospital to tend to patients. And those staff allowed to remain at Nasser have described being ordered to move seriously ill patients between buildings, being taken away from their duties to be interrogated, and assigned patients whose cases they were not trained to deal with. As a result, multiple medics told the BBC that 13 patients died in the days following Israel's takeover of the hospital. Michael, again, I say that word a lot, extraordinary story. What's really interesting here for me is that the BBC have done everything. They've gone absolutely overboard almost with the amount of data they've got, multiple video accounts, multiple witness testimonies. You know, they've got people saying that dozens of other people are saying that people are missing. So we know that people are missing. We clearly know that somebody has had at least one hand broken. And we know that people were being held in front of the hospital, some of which were medical staff, naked, just in their underwear. A huge amount of information there. Israel not really saying anything beyond the fact that we don't use torture. But what do you make of it? Particularly the fact that the BBC have really gone in such depth on this investigation.
We have seen over and over again sort of many sort of mainstream media outlets in some of their prominent framing, we found it sort of deeply, overly sympathetic, overly credulous towards sort of messages put out by the Israeli side. But then every now and again, we do get these reports from the BBC. I mean, there have been a number from the BBC, but we've even seen them from sort of CNN outlets, which are sort of historically and throughout most of this conflict have been fairly pro-Israel. They do investigations, and when they do the investigations, they find out that the Israelis, you know, have done some atrocities and aren't being particularly honest about it. And I suppose just we've talked about hospitals a lot since October the 7th and Israel's bombardment of Gaza. And I just think if you think of sort of the sequence of talking points when it comes to hospitals, so you've got the Al-Ahli hospitals. That was the sort of the first time that we were all talking about hospitals because there was this shelling of people outside the Al-Ahli hospital. And then we heard the Israelis sort of say, oh, we wouldn't possibly do that. We would never, ever shell a hospital. It must have been a misfired Hamas rocket. And then we've got all the various sort of different perspectives and different arguments and theories when it came to how that explosion happened. But then within a month or so, you've got pretty much every hospital, you know, within a couple of months, every hospital in Gaza has by that point been subject to shelling or raided or put under siege, right? And then suddenly the narrative has changed. It's not, oh, we would never attack a hospital. It's, oh, of course we're attacking the hospitals. That's because they've got loads of Hamas operatives under them. Then they get control of the hospitals. It turns out there aren't any huge command centers. There might be a couple of tunnels here or there, but there isn't this big command center under, it was the Al-Shifa hospital at that period, was there? And each time I feel like we've almost sort of forgotten because we moved on. And now we're on this position where they're literally torturing doctors. So we would never bomb a hospital. We're bombing the hospitals, but only because we want to get to the Hamas headquarters underneath them. Now I mean, you'd expect them to say we'd never torture doctors, but it seems like they're not denying this. And now we're literally torturing doctors. And I don't know how the hell they're going to justify this. I suppose the doctors, even though they've got these medical qualifications and have been, you know, doing amputations with no anesthetic, they'll then be smeared as Hamas. Oh, of course we had to torture them. They were Hamas. You know, where will this end? And yet, you wouldn't have thought it would go this far. You know, if someone had said, when we were having this debate about sort of Al Ahly Hospital and everyone was saying, where would it have come from? Different visual analyses. Within 4 months, we're going to have an analysis which is showing that Israel's literally just torturing doctors, going into hospitals and torturing doctors. It's just, where can this end?
Yeah, it really does defy belief. You have this meme almost where the Israelis say, we have the most moral army in the world. The IDF is the most moral army in the world. It's like, it's the least moral army in the world. Russia and Ukraine has done many unsavory things, occupying US and UK forces in Iraq, particularly the US, obviously there's more of them, the same. But torturing medical staff, I mean, lining them up in front of a hospital and that's subsequently leading to patients dying, I don't think I can recall that coming from, certainly in terms of military operations by a quote-unquote Western power. I know Israel's in the Middle East, but, you know, they're a close ally of the US, UK. They have F-35s. They're the first ever country to use F-35s in combat. I think they can be classified as a sort of quote-unquote Western power. Just incredible. Just incredible. Going back to that top story, Sunak's, surprise, surprise, Sunak's spokesperson has now said Hester's comments are racist. I wonder if it had anything to do with Diane Abbott reporting those comments to the police. Here's the quote that's been broken by Kate McCann on Twitter. The comments allegedly made by Frank Hester were racist and wrong. He has now rightly apologised for the offence. So it's only alleged, but he's rightly apologised, okay, for the offence caused, and where remorse is shown, it should be accepted. Well, particularly if he gives us £10 million. The Prime Minister is clear there is no place for racism in public life. And as the first British Asian Prime Minister leading one of the most ethnically diverse cabinets in our history, the UK is living proof of that fact. Wow. What evasion. Look, Britain's not a racist. Nobody said Britain's a racist country. They said the guy who is the biggest funder in the history of the Conservative Party made a racist comment. He did. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I mean, these people are just ridiculous. You know, there's been talk recently, it was one story we didn't cover today, of a potential relaunch of the party in the Red Wall. They're going to use Boris Johnson. He's not that popular, but he's, believe it or not, still the most popular Conservative politician in the country, although Farage is more popular, according to YouGov anyway. They're going to use Boris and David Cameron. You think, okay, Cameron to sort of Lib Dem Tory waverers in the South, Boris Johnson to Brexiteer voters. Okay, might work. And then you see nonsense like this, and no, I think these guys really are rattled beyond even our comprehension here at Navarra Media. Next story. Sophie Ridge from Sky News recently sat down with Keir Starmer for a one-on-one interview. While much of their conversation focused on Starmer's personal story, there were also some moments of political substance. In particular, the Labour leader was quizzed about whether his numbers add up.
I want you to be honest with people. What are you going to do? Are you going to become the austerity prime minister if you win the election?
Be an awful inheritance if we're privileged enough to come into power. They've damaged the economy. They've damaged our public services. And we have to change that. I ran a public service, so I don't need anybody to tell me how important it is that our public services are properly supported and properly funded. We have to ensure that we've got an economy that is thriving, because at the bottom of all of this is the fact the economy's been stagnant for 40
I know you want to
years.
Grow the economy, so but that's not going to happen on day one. You know, well, I want Sheffield Wednesday to win the Premier League. I know it's not going to happen this season. You know.
But there's a lot of things we can do very quickly. The changing of planning regulations and rules can be done very, very quickly.
Councils are going bust.
The National Wealth Fund.
Councils are going bust now.
Yes.
There's a 5.5 year, and I know you'll care about this, there's a 5.5 year average wait from a rape being committed to that person seeing justice. What are you going to do straight away if you're in number 10? Be honest. Are you going to borrow more? Or are you going to enact austerity?
Well, where we are going to be able to put money into our public services, we've been clear that we'll do that. So when it comes to the NHS, 2 million reduction in the waiting lists by the scheme that we've got to work 24/7. With our schools,
I'm not talking about the initial
VAT, so we can put more teachers into our schools.
1.7 billion pounds. IFS is 20 billion. £1 billion in public services and you're not being honest about what you're going to do. This is your chance. Tell people.
We need to ensure that the economy is growing. We can turn that around.
It's not going to happen on day one.
Please, just hear me out.
It's not
telling me.
It's not.
Planning can be changed very, very quickly. That will have a massive impact on growth. The second thing is our National Wealth Fund, which will bring in private investment. I talk to private investors all of the time, and they say to me, Keir, we've got the money to invest right now in your country, but we're not going to do that because we don't see the stability. We don't see the conditions in which we're going to invest.
Notice there that Starmer talks about the National Wealth Fund, which by the way, will need money. You can't just have a National Wealth Fund. We'll invest in places, but we won't capitalize it with any money. He conflates the National Wealth Fund with stability. They're two separate things, Keir. And that really underscores how this was a completely meandering, meaningless answer. 5 years from somebody being raped to getting justice, 5 years, what will you do? I'll change planning laws. Okay. Starmer proceeded to talk about the scale of the challenge Labour stands to inherit.
We are going to inherit a really badly damaged economy after 14 years of failure. Our job is to pick it up, stand it back up, and move our country forward. And I'm not going to shy away from that or provide easy answers to that.
Or not any
we've got
answers.
We've got to grow our economy. Now, you may say that's not an answer you like. I say it's the only answer.
It's a long-term answer, but it's not telling me what you're going to do.
Well, I don't think that it is going to take that long to get our economy going. I think we can turn it around very, very quickly. But what I'm not going to do is make the mistake of saying that or pretending there are easy answers. Unfunded spending commitments are what Liz Truss installed on the country, and we're all paying the price. Last week, you saw in that budget, at the very end, staggeringly, the Chancellor announced £46 billion of an unfunded commitment to get rid of national insurance. We're not going to make that mistake, because in the end, who pays the price for that? It's working people, and I'm not going to allow that to happen under a Labour government.
It's really important that we're honest about what Labour stands to inherit. That's pretty much the only moment, I think, of insight from Keir Starmer over that whole 18-minute interview, particularly after the latest budget. Indeed, following that budget last week, Citibank, the American bank, said Britain would struggle to achieve its growth targets and that productivity growth would remain at around 0.5%. If productivity doesn't go up, growth doesn't go up, taxes don't go up, you get the picture. And that's enough to worsen the borrowing outlook by around £30 to £35 billion, if Citibank are correct. In fact, City economist Benjamin Nabarro said the UK could be, quote, fiscally offside by around £50 to £60 billion, falling to £15 to £20 billion if bonds rally as we currently expect. In other words, best case scenario, Hunt's numbers are out by £15 billion. So it's no surprise that the Resolution Foundation called that budget fiscal fiction. Fiscal fiction. Then there's the fact that dozens of councils around the country face going bankrupt. It's already happening in Birmingham. So even just to keep us where we presently are, which isn't a great place, a Labour government would have to find tens of billions of extra cash. That's before investing in the NHS or building infrastructure. Now, it's not all bad. For instance, Labour can reverse the recent national insurance cuts by the Tories. National insurance went down from 12 to 10%. It'll now go down to 8%. That's a start. Only there's one problem with that. They've claimed they won't do it. And on additional money going to the NHS, which Keir Starmer talked about there, so Keir, that was coming from a tax on non-doms. The Tories have just nicked that tax and it's paying for the national insurance cuts. Deeply unserious responses from a deeply unserious man. And I really sympathise with Sophie Ridge when she says, come on. He's saying there are no easy answers. There were no answers. Michael, what's your read on that interview and Keir Starmer's 2 minutes there, really? Which I think in many ways the most revealing 2 minutes he's offered so far in terms of how he'll govern.
I mean, it's good she got him to be explicit about what the plan is, right? So the plan is basically, well, we do forget as well, actually, because not much extra money for public services, right? But as the IFS have shown, what the current budget from the Tories sort of implies, and if Labour are going to go along with those spending plans, actually we're going to see another £20 billion in cuts to unprotected services. So that's not health or education. So there will be further austerity if, you know, Labour do what they say they're going to do. In terms of the sort of longer term issue, sort of the 5-year plan, she has got them to explicitly say, our growth plan is this, right? Our growth plan is planning reform. Our growth plan is a national wealth fund, which won't really be capitalized with much public money. But Keir Starmer is assured that international investors will pump enough money into the economy to make that happen because of stability. So those are the two ones, aren't they? And I'd like to see that modeled, really. You know, because before it was a bit, it's less vague than it used to be. He said, we want growth, and sort of ended. We want growth, and we're going to get there by planning reform, and we're going to get there by having some international investment because we offer stability. Maybe, you know, can we see that fleshed out, right? Can we see some modeling? Can we see an academic paper or a paper from a think tank that sort of really does suggest that those two policies, there are only two policies, right? So not a particularly ambitious plan, but these two policies, could that really up growth by 1% a year or an amount which would be significant enough that you can keep to the same fiscal rules whilst not having a completely collapsed justice system, completely collapsed local councils? Because by the way, those are both things which are outside of those protected areas. So those would expect, you know, those £20 billion in annual cuts would be expected to hit local authorities and justice. So, yeah, we're closer to, I don't want to call it a plan because I think that would be overstating it. We're closer to some honesty about what the promise is. Now, can we see any particular reason why we should believe that's remotely plausible, that those two policies would lead to enough growth that public services aren't still due to collapse?
I think that's right. But what I would say, Michael, is that, look, Keir Starmer is clearly moving to a place now where he's not offering, you know, the moon on a stick, right? But like I said earlier, I think just to stand still, you're probably going to have to reverse these national insurance tax cuts, which, by the way, you know, that's very easy to do because it's only just been sort of people aren't, you know, assuming that money's there. And that's a lot of money. You're looking at tens of billions of pounds from that. And by the way, I think they'll do that. I think they're going to have to do it. And I just, I find this whole sort of argument so stupid. You know, we're not going to lie to people, blah, blah. You're going to have to increase some taxes from somewhere. You are lying to people. And if you don't, it goes back to your point about local government, Michael, council tax will go up. Council tax will go up. If you're not going to increase taxes at a national level somewhere, and you're going to continue to underfund councils and they're facing bankruptcy, business rates and council tax will go up. Now, I don't know how good your growth model is. We're going to get growth. We're going for growth. If you're going to have businesses bludgeoned by business rates being increased, by the way, Labour have committed to reforming business rates. Again, if you're going to get rid of business rates, where's the money going to come from? And my mother-in-law, Michael, I think she's a very wise woman. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. She said, look, the Tories talk about tax cuts, but then your council tax goes up. They rob Peter to pay Paul. And I feel like, you know, if the Tories weren't so remiss in that department, that would be a useful line of attack against the Labour Party, you know. And I feel like we are headed towards permanent dysfunction in local government because at a national level, no political party is being honest about the need to increase some taxes. I wouldn't increase tax on working people. I would increase capital gains, for instance. They won't be honest about that. So, of course, councils have to increase council tax. Well, let them be hated. What's your read on that? Do you think we'd see a big rise in council tax? And how might Labour respond?
Money has to come from somewhere, right? So either it's the case that planning reform and some international investors having new confidence because Keir Starmer's got a nice haircut, right? Either that brings around really intense growth, or taxes are going to have to be increased at a national or a local level, as you say, or they're going to have to change the sort of statutory obligations of councils. So councils at the moment, I think about 70% of their budgets goes on older people that need care, adult social care, and then children who have sort of extra needs. So councils are responsible for sort of getting them to special education schools. And this is sort of costing them lots of money. In part, I think, because there's a bit of a some monopoly power when it comes to the service providers. So I suppose they could do something about that. But I think either you're going to have taxes increasing somewhere, or you're going to have services declining and actually statutory obligations of councils falling. So literally saying, okay, you know, it was the case that you had to provide X, Y, Z for kids with learning difficulties. We're going to take away the Z. You just have to provide X, Y. Like, that's the only way you're going to make it work, unless all of these councils end up going bust. So I suppose it's, you know, pick your poison. And yeah, Labour aren't being honest because they're saying we can have it all because suddenly we're going to get sort of Chinese style growth because of some planning reform.
Yeah. There's one comment here saying council tax is going up. I know, but you said 10%. Generally speaking, it's hard to push it by 5%. You need certain measures taking place. My point is, you ain't seen nothing yet. Okay. Because if you continue to underfund local services, everybody is going to see council tax rises like they're about to see in Birmingham. 20% over 18 months. 20%. Not 5%. 20%. And that won't be the end of it. Because, of course, you know, if you're caring for older people, we have an aging population, it ain't going south, is it? Finally on Starmer, the Times published this story. Revealed, Keir Starmer's plan to revolutionise the way Britain is governed. The party leader has plans for a powerful new executive cabinet and mission boards to focus on his priorities after the general election. Now, the short of this is that Starmer will create these mission boards to monitor progress for Labour's missions, things like net zero, growth, and that executive cabinet will make key decisions in advance of them being presented to the cabinet proper. It will consist of Keir Starmer, obviously, Rachel Reeves, Angela Rayner, and Pat McFadden. Keir Starmer also intends to create a new policy delivery unit, reporting directly to him, very presidential, which would concentrate on his priorities across Whitehall. He's also considering appointing a senior business figure to run that unit. Michael, there's some things I like about this. I think we should centralise more power in the Prime Minister. I think we should give some power away. We should devolve lots of power to regions, to cities. But I think where national government is tasked to do things, it should be accountable for them and deliver them. Is this showing how serious Starmer is about governing? Because on the one hand, talking to Sophie Ridge, he doesn't sound very serious. And then you read something like this and you think, okay, there's a bit of a strategy here about how to execute.
I mean, in a way, the Labour Party are just trying to work out what can we possibly put in our manifesto that isn't going to cost any extra money. And this isn't going to cost any extra money. So, you know, there's a very simple explanation as to why we're hearing this now, right? I don't necessarily think this is sort of, they thought, what is the thing that we can do to bring about growth? And they've decided, it's this. This is going to be the key to growth. I think they're like, what can we promise? We need some announcements. We can't spend any money. And this is a cheap thing to do. I suppose if you do want to look on the bright side, potentially you could argue that one of the reasons why, you know, nothing is working in Britain at the moment is partly because, you know, we had this false dogma of austerity, which seems to sort of be hanging around, unfortunately. But also, the Tory party have just been stagnant and obsessed with internal fights for a number of years now. So nothing really works. You know, you're looking at Dominic Cummings' Twitter. I never know how much to believe the guy, but he's sort of saying, you know, he tried to go in there, big plans, big projects, and everyone was too busy in factional infighting or sort of stagnant myopia that we couldn't get it done. So if you wanted to look on the bright side, you could say maybe getting a new bunch of guys in there who have been thinking about this for a while. They shouldn't really be sort of angling as to who's going to be the next leader as obsessively as they are in the Conservative Party. Maybe just that little bit of new energy and momentum will make governance a bit more effective than it has been for the past 5 years or so. But yeah, I mean, we're somewhat clutching at straws here, but I want to end on a positive.
They will be better than the Tories. Quickly, to finish on this story, the subtext for me is that they're taking on the Treasury. You know, if all of a sudden you're centralizing power at number 10, it sounds like you're taking power away from the Treasury. I find this really interesting because, of course, you've had this story about the OBR will basically sign off on Labour policy. If it makes sense for the OBR, it happens. If it doesn't, it doesn't happen. I think that's ridiculous, but there you go. Government by Quango. This sounds at odds with that because you're saying not government by Quango. We're centralising executive power at number 10. Very interesting. Very interesting. We've not detected any tensions between Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer, but that's interesting. That number 10, number 11 conflict, it hints at that. Michael, You've been very good this evening, as always. I'm used to seeing you in HD as the host, but it was good to see you coming from home. Your plant is looking very healthy. I trust a person who has green fingers.
I've got a dying plant in the other part of my room. I've been lobbying also for a more HD camera, so I'll send some messages after this show.
Good PR there to have the dying plant just out of shot. And thanks to all of you for tuning in tonight. My name's Aaron Mastani. You've been watching Navara Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navara Media. Go to navaramedia.com/support.